This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning and welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane. Coming up, calls for help to a veteran's mental health service double after the release of a report investigating alleged war crimes in Afghanistan. And the debate over whether to build a bridge across the Daintree River to improve access to the World Heritage Listed Rainforest in far north Queensland.
If we're to remain attractive to tourists, we need to have some progress, but we need to be careful about which bits of progress we select.
We don't need Disneyland on the Daintree. We don't need another Gold Coast.
Earlier this month, there were none. Now, there are three potential COVID-19 vaccines that could begin to be rolled out before the end of the year. The latest is from Oxford University, and scientists say it's at least 70% effective, it's cheap and easy to distribute. And surprisingly, they say if half a dose is given first, 4 weeks before a full dose, it's up to 90% effective. Australia's already bought more than 33 million doses, with more than 3 million of them available early next year. Europe correspondent Samantha Hawley reports.
The science is catching up with the disease.
Vaccines are now edging ever closer to liberating us from the virus.
Still self-isolating himself, Boris Johnson virtually addressed the House of Commons, heaping praise on the Oxford University scientists who've declared they've developed a vaccine for the world.
The scientific cavalry is now in sight.
After a mass trial, the vaccine that's administered in two doses was found to provide between 70 and 90% protection. The figures aren't as good as the 95% recorded by the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines, but the Oxford AstraZeneca jab has its own advantages. It's cheaper and can simply be refrigerated rather than needing freezing at minus 70 degrees. The trial's lead investigator is Professor Andrew Pollard.
70% is a highly effective vaccine.
While Australia has almost 4 million doses on order, the British government has 4 million ready to go and 96 million to come. So optimistic is the British Health Secretary, Matt Hancock. He thinks life will be back to normal by Easter.
We hope to be able to start vaccinating next month. The bulk of the vaccine rollout programme will be in January, February, March.
One battle ahead will be convincing people to line up for the jab. And England's chief medical officer, Professor Jonathan Van Tam, is concerned the vaccine excitement could bring its own harm.
There is going to be a very sad irony if some people catch COVID-19 through not following the rules that would have been eligible for a vaccine in January or February.
While lauding the success of British scientists, the Prime Minister Boris Johnson was also spreading some Christmas hope, announcing families will be able to travel to celebrate, but urging caution.
This virus obviously is not going to grant a Christmas truce. It doesn't know it's Christmas.
A new three-tier system will be introduced once the current national lockdown ends next week. Many parts of the country will remain with the strictest restrictions, while in others, spectators will even be allowed back to sports. And by January, Boris Johnson has promised to use mass rapid testing to offer daily tests to people rather than forcing them to self-isolate.
We have turned a corner and the escape route is in sight.
But there are many long cold months between now and Easter. This is Samantha Hawley in London reporting for AM.
Calls for help to veterans' mental health services have doubled following the release of a landmark report investigating alleged war crimes by Australian Special Forces in Afghanistan. While defence leaders have called out the shocking behaviour detailed in the inquiry, they've been pleading with the broader community to respect the commitment of servicemen and women and not let the behaviour of a few tarnish the reputation of all. And the reason for that? Concerns about the mental health of veterans. From Canberra, political reporter Matthew Doran.
19 current and former ADF personnel are now facing the prospect of criminal investigation, with findings they were involved in the killing of 39 prisoners and civilians and the cruel treatment of two more. The reaction from the veteran community to those disturbing findings is becoming clear.
What we've seen over the weekend is an increase in anxiety, and we actually had a doubling of phone calls to our support line over the weekend.
Dr. Stephanie Hodson is the National Manager of Open Arms, the Veterans and Family Counselling Service run by the Department of Veterans Affairs.
People are very, very proud of their service. Many people went overseas and they sacrificed time away from their families to go and serve. This does cause you to question, you know, was my service worthwhile?
Even before Justice Paul Brereton's findings were revealed, defence leaders were worried about the impact they may have on the mental health of current and former ADF members. Dr. Hodson isn't necessarily perturbed by the recent doubling of calls for support. Rather, she believes it's a welcome sign people know help is out there.
And I think the trouble is when people aren't connected is when we actually lose people.
Social isolation is a huge factor in people's mental health, in poor mental health.
Georgia Ash is the National Clinical Manager of Mates for Mates, a physical, psychological and social support service established by the Queensland RSL. She believes it's vital the public rallies around the defence community.
This is not reflective of the whole ADF community. And if we allow ourselves to throw the baby out with the bathwater, so to speak, then that is not going to be helpful to us as a society.
Someone who spent years investigating how veterans adjust to life back in society is Associate Professor Ben Wadham from Flinders University. A former soldier turned sociologist, he fears Afghan veterans could face the same public response as those who served in Vietnam.
There is the red flag, I guess, the potential for parts of the community to become very angry and to become dismissive or reactive against veterans.
Associate Professor Wadham argues apart from more mental health support, there needs to be a public education campaign on how the military works.
When the Brereton report comes out, the war crimes allegations come out, it feeds into these kind of suspicions about the military as being hierarchical and command-driven.
Much of the focus on veterans' mental health has recently been on those taking their own lives, and legislation is currently before Parliament to establish a National Commissioner for Veteran Suicide. The federal government hopes to have that legislation pass before the end of the year.
Matthew Doran reporting there. Greg Mellick is the National President of the RSL and the Australian Commando Association. He's told RN Breakfast the public should remember the families of the 26,000 Australians who've served in Afghanistan.
I mean, we're hearing now as a result of these allegations that children are being harassed at school, including a child whose father died in Afghanistan, being told that your father died because he was a killer. I would urge the public to take a step back, realise there are very serious allegations, but people entitled to a due process and think about their families and stop making wild allegations.
That's RSL President Greg Mellick. And if you're a veteran or serving member and you and your family need help, you can call the organisation Open Arms, 1800 011 046. Criminal charges have reportedly been laid against airport police in Qatar after a number of Australian women were subjected to an invasive search while travelling through Doha last month. In a statement carried by Reuters news agency, Qatari authorities say those charged could face several years in jail. An Australian lawyer who speaks for some of the women says they're still waiting for an individual apology for their ordeal, and he intends to take up the issue directly with Qatari authorities. Barbara Miller reports.
Offensive and grossly inappropriate is how Australia's government described the treatment of 18 women taken off a plane bound for Sydney and subjected to what they called invasive examinations to see whether they were the mother of a newborn baby found abandoned at Hamad Airport in Doha. This woman, who spoke to the ABC last month, said she felt she had no choice but to go through with the procedure.
If that's what I had to do to get back on the plane and to get back into Sydney, you know, I didn't want to do it, but if that's what I needed to do, I was prepared to do that to get back on the plane to get out of there.
Now the legal reckoning with the incident appears to be underway. In a statement carried by the Reuters news agency, Qatar's public prosecutor says an unspecified number of airport police officers have been charged. The statement also says legal proceedings have begun against the mother of the abandoned baby, who Qatar describes as of Asian nationality, and whose understood to have left the country. And it also claims the father of the baby has been identified through a DNA test. Qatari authorities issued a sincere apology for the incident after media reports about it late last month. Dr. Wolfgang Babeck is a solicitor in New South Wales and international constitutional lawyer. He was also a passenger on the plane from which the women were removed. He says Qatari authorities have not reached out to the women individually with an apology or compensation offer, and a group of around five of them have asked him to contact the authorities on their behalf.
The women would like to have some compensation, yes. Some are in, you know, they are receiving mental support still because it has been such a traumatic incident. However, they're very interested to strengthen the rights of women in general because they believe that this is what they have gone through is a good trigger to table this problem.
And when and how do you intend to contact Qatari authorities?
Oh, momentarily, because the group has just been going through this discussion. As you might have known, there was an interview by one of the women who had the strength to speak out to a television channel. So this is happening as we speak.
Qatar's state news agency tweeted overnight that Australia's ambassador, Jonathan Muir, met with the Qatari Minister of State for Foreign Affairs. There are no details about what was discussed. Last week, the office of Foreign Minister Maurice Payne told the ABC the government was still waiting on a report of the airport incident from Qatar. The minister's office has been contacted for comment this morning.
Barbara Miller reporting. Small businesses are chalking up millions of dollars in losses after being targeted by increasingly sophisticated cyber criminals. Now questions are being asked about whether the banks are doing enough to stop fraudulent accounts being set up by the scammers to shift money offshore. Consumer Affairs reporter Amy Bainbridge has the story.
Like many small business owners, concreter Simon O'Donnell has taken a financial hit during the pandemic. Making a bad year worse is that he's been embroiled in a sophisticated cyber scam.
He feels completely helpless of, from a lay angle, done nothing wrong. Finished a good job for someone, he was happy with the job, and I'm a lot of money out of pocket for 6 months, which during COVID hasn't been ideal whatsoever.
In May, Simon completed a concreting job for a local builder and sent his invoice for $51,000 via email. But hackers intercepted the invoice and changed the bank details before sending it on. Jane Fleming runs the building business with her husband and paid the invoice, unknowingly transferring money to a Commonwealth Bank account held by a scammer.
And I didn't know that an invoice could be intercepted between a supplier and ourselves and altered. I didn't realise that was a thing.
It wasn't until Simon said he hadn't received the payment that they both checked the invoice and realised the change.
It was pretty stressful. Yeah, it was a horrible day. Just felt sick all day. Yeah, just wondering where this 50 grand was.
Police have investigated and told the ABC the invoice was intercepted using malware and the money was sent to an account likely set up online under a false name and address before being moved to other accounts and withdrawn overseas. Associate Professor Paul Haskell-Dowland from Edith Cowan University has examined the emails and the invoices.
And because it's a text-based document, it would have been very hard for an attacker to develop some automated tool to do this. It would actually require a human to go in, upload the file to modify the details, download it again, and then reattach it to an email to send on to the unsuspecting victim. So this kind of scam is not massively common, but it certainly happens with a level of regularity.
They're known as business email compromise scams, and last year they cost Australian businesses $132 million. Small Business and Family Enterprise Ombudsman Kate Carnell is fielding hundreds of complaints about the issue this year.
What we're seeing is a significant increase, and some of that increase we think is because people are working from home with less secure systems and possibly there are more people at home, criminals at home, attempting to make some money on the side and using cyber crime to do that.
Jane Fleming and Simon O'Donnell's disbelief has turned to anger directed at the Commonwealth Bank. Jane complained to the bank and the Australian Financial Complaints Authority, but was told because they're not Commonwealth Bank customers, they can't help them.
I'd like this to be resolved by CBA acknowledging that they are negligent and allowing criminals from overseas to operate in Australia.
She's now lodged a case against her bank, Bendigo Bank, to try and retrieve the money. Bendigo Bank says it's sympathetic to the customers impacted by the fraud and it can't comment while it processes the complaint. The Commonwealth Bank says it acted quickly to block the account and it has provided information to authorities.
Consumer Affairs reporter Amy Bainbridge. Think back to this time last year, most of us were unprepared for the summer bushfires that devastated parts of southeastern Australia. The COVID pandemic since overshadowed the fires and the recovery. The National Australia Bank boss, Ross McEwen, has been visiting regional Victoria in recent days, meeting people who are still trying to rebuild their lives and businesses. Mr. McEwen says bushfire-hit communities need to prepare for future natural disasters, and he warns that climate change needs to be taken much more seriously. Ross McEwen's still out on the road and he's speaking here with our senior business correspondent, Peter Ryan.
We're certainly still seeing the effects of the bushfires. I met a farmer still having to replace fencing and at about $40,000 per kilometre. And he's got 8 kilometres to do. It's a big expense. But, you know, they're a hardy group. They're getting on with life, but it has been devastating. And what is showing up is that we need a lot of people better prepared for these fires, droughts, and also some of the rains that have been happening as well.
You say it's now a case of being better prepared. So is that the NAB, like other banks now, factoring in climate change or climate-driven disasters into their business plans?
It's more than just into our business plans. It's helping customers with their own planning. And we've done a piece of research recently which showed customers actually expect their bank to be more helpful with the planning before a disaster. As part of our grants program this year, we're putting an additional $1.2 million into community grants to do exactly that, to actually rebuild.
So by getting out there and helping communities face future disasters, is that an acknowledgement that climate change really needs to be taken much more seriously?
Oh, it needs to be taken very seriously. We're seeing the ramifications of, you know, the devastation caused by effectively climate change over a long period of time. We need to accept that there are going to be ramifications going forward. We need to do our bit to get the carbon levels down. So, you know, we as a bank are doing our share in that, but also working with our customers to help them get into a much better position, particularly for their businesses.
Last summer, banks committed millions of dollars to help communities to recover from the bushfires. But are you concerned now that that was helpful, but in many ways a band-aid?
What is very clear is that we need an ongoing program to keep the awareness up and to keep the planning going. And I think that's a role that we as a bank are certainly going to be playing.
How have you been personally affected when you've been dealing with people face-to-face who've been coping with devastating losses?
Well, it's so nice to be able to get out and just be reminded of what did happen a year ago and the ramifications of it today. It's good for the boss to be out there and be reminded of what is going on and what our role in communities are.
Your research shows the biggest impact has been with temporary disruptions, higher costs and business closures, but this has been in many ways camouflaged by the COVID crisis.
When you have a look at what happened in the last 12 months, we started with drought. We went straight into horrific fires, and then within a month of those abating a wee bit, we were into a major COVID shutdown pretty much across the country. And it did mask a lot of the fire damage that was done and the ramifications for people and the very human nature of the damage that was done. But, you know, the rural community is very resilient and it's certainly picking itself up, but it'll take another couple of years to really get over last year's fires.
When you've been speaking to people who are still hurting from the bushfires, do they tell you that they feel they've been sidelined given the focus, understandably, on COVID?
No, I don't think it's so much being sidelined. I think they've just had to get on with their lives and try and repair as much as they can, remembering there were houses lost, there were implement sheds lost. You know, it's going to take a number of years for this to come through, and our research has shown that they're still going to need a lot of support.
How confident are you feeling now that a slow economic recovery is underway, especially now that restrictions are eased in Victoria and the border with New South Wales is now open?
We saw, for example, Victoria in its first week of bouncing back, it bounced back very strongly, and same into the second week. You're seeing businesses start to get going again that were impacted. You're starting to see people holiday and start moving around, which is vitally important to get the economy going. So I'm more buoyed by it than I thought I would have been. Consumption's up, housing has held up. And I think by the time we get to the end of next year, we'll probably be back to a growth level that we were at in 2019.
Third quarter GDP is out next week. That's after a 7% contraction in the prior quarter. How confident are you feeling about a slightly positive result?
You may get a very slight increase in GDP coming through. That would be a delight to see the end of the recessionary days, but we've got a long way to go to rebuild a 7% GDP drop. But, you know, this country of all countries is very capable of that. People are optimistic and want to get on with life, and that's what we're seeing happening. So I wouldn't be at all surprised if it was slightly positive.
On a separate matter, consumer advocates and charities are quite concerned about moves to perhaps wind back responsible lending laws. What's the NAB's stance on that?
Well, first off, we should never be lending any money to people that we don't think have got a fairly good chance of getting that back to us. It's not good for them. It's not good for the bank itself, and certainly not good for the shareholders of the bank.
You're in the top job at the NAB because of the Banking Royal Commission, which claimed the career of your predecessor, Andrew Thorburn. How important is it for the financial sector and the federal government to get this right?
Oh, vitally important. I've seen the consequences of this outside of the Australian shores, up in the UK and in America, where the banking sector got it wrong and completely overlent. So, you know, responsible lending to me is fundamental to banking, but that's where it should be. So we've got to get it right.
And that's Ross McEwan. He's the Chief Executive of the National Australia Bank. And he was speaking with our Senior Business Correspondent, Peter Ryan. It's been almost 40 years since a massive environmental campaign attempted to stop the construction of a road through the World Heritage-listed Daintree Rainforest in far north Queensland. Now there's a new debate over whether a bridge should replace the current Daintree River ferry, which is the only way to travel north from Port Douglas to Cape Tribulation and beyond. Jemima Burt reports.
If you live north of the Daintree River, or you're a tourist heading for the ancient Daintree Rainforest and Cape York, the ferry crossing is the only way in and out. There are often long delays, which is why the Douglas Shire Council is asking residents if they want a two-lane bridge to be built across the river, or a second ferry crossing to be set up. Michael Kerr is the local mayor.
Tourists having to wait up to 2-3 hours, you know, and then you throw the mix in of locals who lived there as well. You know, sometimes it was taking people 3 hours to pick their kids up from school.
Lawrence Mason owns a cafe at Cape Tribulation, north of the Daintree River.
And some of us in business here actually experience the negative aspects of that when we get the cranky people arriving here. It destroys their experience. If we're to remain attractive to tourists, we need to have some progress, but we need to be careful about which bits of progress we select.
Transport links to the Daintree have long been controversial. Conservationists, including the Douglas Shire Sustainability Group, have started a petition against the bridge. President Didge McDonald says it has 23,000 signatures.
It's a international icon. It's one of the oldest rainforests in the world. And it's a finite space. You need to be very, very careful in how you develop the place.
Conservationists have also written to UNESCO to voice their concerns.
We don't need Disneyland on the Daintree. We don't need another Gold Coast.
David White operates crocodile tours along the river. He'd prefer to see better traffic management options investigated before crossing capacity is increased.
There are a few buses going around in a loop and you get on and off the bus wherever you want. The majority of people that make up the traffic are day visitors, and I don't think they've talked about that option enough.
The council will release the results of its resident survey next week, and Mayor Michael Kerr says the five councillors will support whatever outcome it shows.
Either way, they both have their pros and cons, but if we do go ahead with the two ferry system, the ratepayers will more than likely be the ones that will be out of pocket.
Cafe owner Lawrence Mason says either option would aid the local economy.
I think a bit more development would be good here. We need a few more families living here because our school numbers are declining.
But tour operator David White isn't sure that anything that increases traffic in the Daintree is worth it.
People are coming here for the natural beauty, and we've got to look after that natural beauty, otherwise they won't come anymore. It'll be loved to death.
That's tour operator David White ending that report from our reporter Jemima Burt in Cairns. That is AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Stephen Smiley.
And I'm Angela Voipierre, and we're from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal. It's finally happening. The frontrunner COVID-19 vaccines are getting results from their clinical trials. And they're good. So good, in fact, that the US, UK and Germany are planning to start their vaccination programs within weeks. Australia, on the other hand, won't reach that point until early next year. So what's the holdup?
Today on The Signal, Australia's place in the vaccine queue and how will the rollout go when it does happen? Look for The Signal on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.